Welcome to the History of Little Europe, episode 1.18, Lenin in Zurich. In the last episode, we covered the evolution of Switzerland from the mostly rural and decentralized state into the highly bureaucratized and business-oriented economy it is today. In this episode, we will watch as this new nation tests the limits of its historical neutrality as Europe lights itself ablaze. Now, it's been a good few years since Europe lit itself on fire. There have been a couple of wars surrounding Germany's establishment and Russian moves into the Balkans, but the continent has not really seen a full-scale war since as far ago as the Seven Years' War. As we move into World War I, I'll be skipping over the usual introduction to the conflict, what with Archduke Franz Ferdinand's assassination, and instead, I want to talk a bit more about the shifting alliances that brought this conflict into being, because that, more than anything else, would prove to be critical for Switzerland. The dynamic of Europe revolved around the alliances of the five great powers: Germany, the UK, France, Austria-Hungary, and Russia. Attached to that was the middle powers of Italy, the Ottoman Empire, Spain, Portugal, and the Benelux. Many are quick to point out that, in the approach to World War I, Germany's choice of Austria-Hungary, arguably the weakest of the five, as its main ally, was of serious detriment, but in truth, this has not been the situation for very long. It is better to look at Germany's alliances up to that point. Under the guidance of Otto von Bismarck, the two countries that the German Empire sought allies out of, more than anything else, were the British and the Russians. Remember that Germany and Russia shared a common enemy in Austria-Hungary, as Prussia had just fought them in the Brothers' War, and Russia was looking to challenge their hegemony in the Balkans. Russia's embarrassment by the UK and French in the Crimean War further emphasized an alliance between the two. As for the UK, the German precursor Prussia had historically been allied closely with the British, and with the French competing heavily against the British colonially, a strong land power seemed like a good choice for an ally. So, what changed all of this? Well, in 1890, Chancellor Bismarck was sacked by Kaiser Wilhelm II. After enjoying the fruits of his political prowess for several decades, the German state found itself instead with a string of rather incompetent chancellors appointed by a very incompetent Kaiser. After spending years cultivating Russia against the surrounded and weak Austria-Hungary, Germany decided to switch sides and join with their Germanic cousins to the south. In turn, rather than continue building alliances with the British, they decided to get into something of a naval arms race with them, which, of course, they lost, because you don't challenge an island nation to sea warfare. Perhaps the only well-placed alliance of this period was one made with Italy, but given that the newly formed nation was looking to challenge Austria-Hungary in the Adriatic, you can probably guess that that didn't last too long. I say all of this to paint a better picture of the situation Switzerland is going to find itself in. To the southwest is the partnership between France and Italy, which was naturally quite tenuous, given that Italy had already switched sides once already. And to the northeast, Germany was partnered to Austria-Hungary, who was both fairly incompetent and had a historical rivalry with the northern German state. Given Switzerland's location between them, it seemed like an ideal location for both making attacks against the enemy, but also in backstabbing an ally, should it come to that. And thus, Switzerland faced encroachment not just on one side, but on all. It was also of no advantage to Switzerland that the ethnicities within the state were pulled toward their respective nations. The German majority favored the Central Powers, while the French and Italian minorities favored the Entente. Internal strife was rampant, a general air of distrust built up, and there was serious concern that the Swiss state would not be able to survive such a conflict. And so, it became quite clear that for the Swiss state to survive this conflict, it would not only need to remain neutral, but take proactive action against encroachment. Rather than relying on treaties to preserve their position, Switzerland actively began building up its military force and defenses. And this would prove more vital than perhaps even they realized at the time. Under the Schlieffen Plan, the German General Staff had opened to the possibility of trying to outflank the French fortifications by marching through Switzerland in violation of its neutrality. In the end, the plan's eventual executor, Helmuth von Moltke the Younger, selected Belgium instead due to Switzerland's mountainous topography and dug in military, which would make any advance slow and painful. Plus, the disorganized state of the Belgian armed forces made for a much more appealing target. From December 1914 until the spring of 1918, Swiss troops were deployed in the Jura along the French border over concern that the trench war might spill into Switzerland. Of lesser concern was the Italian border, but troops were also stationed in the region of Graubünden. During the war, Switzerland was blockaded by the Allies and therefore suffered some difficulties. However, because Switzerland was centrally located, neutral, and generally undamaged, the war allowed the growth of the Swiss banking industry. For the same reasons that Switzerland became a haven for foreign refugees and revolutionaries, the wealthy and powerful across the world found the Swiss stability and neutrality as a far more enticing combination with their money than continental warfare. To this day, Swiss banking benefits greatly from such an attitude, as the more jumpy members of the 1% find the low risk appealing. Following the organization of the army in 1907 and military expansion in 1911, the Swiss army consisted of about 250,000 men, with an additional 200,000 in supporting roles. While the state had not yet implemented the mandatory service that would be a hallmark of the Swiss state in World War II, the country relied on a massive amount of volunteer labor to shore up its defensive lines. Both European alliance systems took the size of the Swiss military into account in their years prior to 1914, and both sides even went so far as to offer military alliances to the nation at various times in the war, but these predictably came to nothing. Following the declarations of war in late July 1914, on August 1st, Switzerland mobilized its army. By August 7th, the newly appointed general, Ulrich Wille, had about 220,000 men under his command. By August 11th, Wille had deployed much of the army along the Jura border with France, with smaller units deployed along the eastern and southern borders. This remained unchanged until May 1915, when Italy entered the war on the Entente side, at which point troops were deployed to the Unterengaden Valley along the southern border. Once it became clear that the Allies and the Central Powers would respect Swiss neutrality, the number of troops deployed began to drop. After September 1914, some soldiers were released to return to their farms and to vital industries. By November 1916, the Swiss had only 38,000 men in the army. This number increased during the winter of 1916 and 1917 to over 100,000 as a result of a proposed French attack that would have crossed Switzerland. When this attack failed to occur, the army began to shrink again. Because of the widespread workers' strikes, at the end of the war, the Swiss army had shrunk to only 12,500 men. But just because the major nations never officially launched attacks does not mean that the front lines were inactive. During the course of the war, various soldiers from all sides crossed the Swiss border an estimated 1,000 times, with some of these incidents occurring around the Dreisprachen Piz, or Three Languages Peak, the languages being Italian, Romansh, and German. Switzerland had an outpost and a hotel, which was destroyed as it was used by the Austrians, on that peak. During the war, fierce battles were fought in the ice and snow of the area, with gunfire even crossing into Swiss areas at times. The three nations made an agreement not to fire over Swiss territory, which jutted out between Austria to the north and Italy to the south. Instead, they could fire down the pass, as Swiss territory was around the peak. In one incident, a Swiss soldier was killed at his outpost on Dreisprachen Piz by Italian gunfire. Perhaps the most critical activities undertaken, though, were not military in nature. During the fighting, Switzerland became a haven for many politicians, artists, pacifists, and thinkers. Bern, Zurich, and Geneva became centers of debate and discussion. In Zurich, two very different anti-war groups would bring lasting changes to the world, the Bolsheviks and the Dadaists. The Bolsheviks, as I'm sure you know, were a faction of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, centered around Vladimir Lenin. Following the outbreak of the war, Lenin was stunned when the large Social Democratic parties of Europe, at that time predominantly Marxist in orientation, supported their various respective countries' war efforts. Lenin was against the war in his belief that the peasants and workers of the proletariat were fighting the battle of the bourgeoisie, and adopted the stance that what he described as an imperialist war ought to be turned into a civil war between the classes. He left Austria for neutral Switzerland in 1914 following the outbreak of the war, and remained active in Switzerland until 1917. Following the 1917 February Revolution in Russia and the abdication of Tsar Nicholas II, he left Switzerland. In no small part, due to the extensive efforts of the German high command, he traveled on the sealed train to Petrograd, where he would shortly lead the 1917 October Revolution in Russia. Thus, Switzerland found itself strikingly connected with the soon-to-be communist takeover of Russia, and many throughout the nation would soon start agitating for the same. The other great movement I spoke of was the Dada Art Movement. This was an anti-war organization, wherein Dadaists would use art to oppose all wars. The founders of the movement had left Germany and Romania to escape the destruction of the war. At the Cabaret Voltaire in Zurich, they put on performances expressing their disgust with the war and with the interests that inspired it. By some accounts, Dada coalesced on October 6, 1916, at the Cabaret. The artists use abstraction to fight against the social, political, and cultural ideas of that time that they believed had caused the war. When World War I ended in 1918, most of the Zurich Dadaists returned to their home countries, and some began Dada activities in other countries. In 1917, Switzerland's neutrality came into question when the Grimm-Hoffmann affair erupted. Robert Grimm, a Swiss socialist politician, traveled to Russia as an activist to negotiate a separate peace between Russia and Germany in order to end the war on the Eastern Front in the interests of socialism and pacifism. Misinterpreting himself as a diplomat and an actual representative of the Swiss government, he made progress, but had to admit to fraud and return home when the Allies found out about the proposed peace deal. Neutrality was restored by the resignation of Arthur Hoffmann, the Swiss federal chancellor, who had supported Grimm, but had not consulted his colleagues on the initiative. The other main role Switzerland played throughout the war was in the continuation of its humanitarian efforts we saw throughout last episode. During the war, Switzerland accepted 68,000 British, French, and German wounded prisoners of war for recovery in mountain resorts. To be transferred, the wounded had to have a disability that would negate their further military service or interned over 18 months and deteriorating mental health. The wounded were transferred from prisoner of war camps, which were unable to cope with the number of wounded, and in exchange sat out the war in Switzerland. The transfer was agreed between the warring powers and organized by the Red Cross. Under the surface, though, something else entirely is brewing. Seeing the success of the Bolsheviks in Russia, the various socialists and communist organizations throughout the state began agitating for a little bit of revolution of their own. Join us next time as this tension bursts out into the strikes of 1918, and Switzerland now finds itself in a very peculiar position compared with the rest of Europe. Until then, share the show, rate the show, subscribe to the show, send me emails at historyoflittleeurope@gmail.com, and until next time, posegnanie, ciao, and goodbye.